She won't ask for it.
Hello, should we start? If we don't know each other already, my name's Robert Douglas Fairhurst. I'm here as the stunt double, the official stunt double of the chair of the faculty, Professor Ros Ballister. Secretly, I'm quite glad because it means I get to introduce this year's visiting Professor of Creative Media, Stig Abel, to you. I first met Stig towards the end of the 1990s. In Cambridge as a young, bumbling, badly dressed book lover. That is, I was young and bumbling and badly dressed. Stig was a little bit younger, but he was also calm under pressure, and he was blisteringly clever, and he had annoyingly nice shoes. If you've listened to his radio show on LBC, or perhaps more recently Front Row on the BBC, you will know that nothing much has changed in terms of being calm and clever, anyway, radio not being a shoe-friendly medium. And it's hard to imagine anyone being better placed to talk about where journalism has got to and where it might be going. For 12 years, Stig worked at the Press Complaints Commission, including the periods of the Levinson inquiry, when often the main item of the news was the news. Soon after that, in a pretty spectacular gamekeeper turned poacher move, he became managing editor of The Sun. And then in May 2016, he succeeded Sir Peter Stoddart as editor and publisher of the TLS, where I think he's done a remarkable job in freshening up the content and especially finding new readers without alienating all the old ones. Most recently, this week, the bookseller announced that Stig's first book is going to be published by John Murray. It looks at what keeps the nation ticking along, or for the more swivel-eyed among us, what makes Britain truly great. Institutions like the military and schools and hospitals and, of course, the media. I've read it in draft. It is wise, it's provocative, it's terrifically entertaining. And when it comes out in May, I strongly urge all of you to buy several copies each. The title is How Britain Really Works. Although I noticed on Twitter earlier this week, the one wag has suggested an even better title would be Stig on This Dump. Anyway, today's lecture is going to be followed by a brief question and answer session. And then, if you want to continue the conversation more informally, we hope you'll be able to join us for a drink in the lobby. But before all that, most importantly, please join me in welcoming Stig Abel.
Thank you so very much for having me. I was at Cambridge for 3 years with Robert, and I only went to one lecture, and it was his, and it was... So it's quite nice that the only lecture I've ever done has been introduced by Robert. I didn't know this at the time, but Cambridge was actually founded by refugees from Oxford. I don't know if you know this as well. They fled their concern at the violence between townies and students in the early Middle Ages. And medieval Oxford was like the village of Midsummer. It was filled with a seemingly inconceivable number of murders. It's a fascinating fact here for you. Early Oxford, this is totally true, had a murder rate of 120 per 100,000. Which, according to something I read in the TLS, so you know it's true, was higher than Caracas or San Pedro, which is in Honduras, currently the two most violent cities in the world not at war. So that was medieval Oxford, worse than Caracas. And it looks a lot nicer now, and so few of you, in fact, appear to be homicidal. So I'm really very glad to be here. And this evening I'm going to be quite rude about social media and tech companies. So I thought in true BBC fashion, I'd attempt some balance. So here is my favorite Twitter joke. I'm sick of you pretending you're a joke, so we should have said, good idea, we can cover more ground that way. So some good things come out of Twitter. This is my favorite Twitter observation from a guy called Alex Andrew. This entire shelf of own brand cereal sounds like an old English army major trying to find a euphemism for gay men. That's marshmallow mateys, tutti fruities, and honey nut scooters. And this is my favourite Twitter video. Ooh. I think we might look at that again, actually, because it is very funny. It's the second fall to the side, I think, that makes it so truly mesmerising. Oh, there it goes. Yeah, very good. Anyway, I just wanted to establish that good things can come from social media, which is useful because so very, very many bad things do as well. But I'm not just going to be rude about newfangled technology this evening. I'm going to be rude about old-fashioned print journalism as well. And here's a crucial text for you, which may act as a summary of this whole talk, TLDR, as I believe the youth say. And it comes from the wonderful American gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson. As far as I'm concerned, it's a damn shame that a field as potentially dynamic and vital as journalism should be overrun with dullards, bums and hacks, hag-ridden with myopia, apathy and complacence, and generally stuck in a bog of stagnant mediocrity. And that's undoubtedly true, and has evidently been true for many years. And so the title of my little talk tonight is The End of Journalism. And I debated for a while about whether to have the question mark at the end or not. And then I thought, why not just take the Daily Mail approach here? Just stick on a question mark to conceal the fact that you might be completely wrong, but don't care enough to check properly. You know, the sort of thing, is your house price linked to the menopause? Are dog-sized rats roaming the streets? And like all bad journalistic habits, it's found an especially comfortable home on the internet. But you find it all over the place, resignedly highlighting an overstated proposition with the miniature distress flare of a question mark. And John Rentoul, the political journalist, has marked out this phenomenon with an abbreviation. You've probably seen it on Twitter, QTWAIN, questions to which the answer is no. So here are some good examples of that. Could Hitler come to power today? Asked The Economist. Is SpongeBob SquarePants the new Che Guevara? Are we literally starving students into submission? Then let's get started on the use of the term literally. Otherwise, we'll get distracted. Has the whole Q2WTN thing run its course yet? That's the goddamn circular irony of the internet from Mr. Dan Hanan, the thinking person's Brexiteering monomaniac. But we digress. We should probably move past that. So here's my question. Is this the end of journalism? Just another vapid Q2TWAIN, another attention grabbing by someone desperate for that attention. We'll see by the end of this talk, because we are living, I think, and this is a serious point, in a period of untrammeled and disconcerting change, not only for the industry of journalism in all of its pomp and pungency, but for the act of human communication, the way in which we connect ourselves to and distance ourselves from our fellow citizens. Until the last decade, and for several decades, we used to congregate in small groups, in physical contact with one another. Information was directly broadcast by privileged sources, with whom we had to make appointments at specific times. We had to listen to the news at 6, or watch it on the TV at 10, or walk to a shop in the morning or evening to buy a copy of a newspaper. And what do we do now? We endlessly scroll down our phones in search of news that will never satisfy us. Technology has turned us all into Tantalus. The thirst for information is completely unconnected to the quality of its supply, and it can't ever be assuaged. There will always be some more news of some sort to read. In 1720, the Gloucester News, a local paper, apologised for this. It said, "We apologise for the present scarcity of news," and it just stopped printing for a little bit. On the 18th of April 1930, this is totally true and slightly unbelievable, the BBC's news announcer's script for the 8:45 bulletin was this: "There is no news." So they played piano music instead, which just sounds brilliant to me, because today there would always be something. There'd always be a reaction to a tweet from a politician or a celebrity, a response to a polemic on Brexit or immigration, a confected controversy about climate change. We are never, collectively as a species, going to return to quietness again. And that has actually all sorts of profound consequences, I think. You know, we're never disconnected from one another, never distinct. Information is democratically shared by everybody all of the time. It's not privileged at all. And that can be a good thing, but it's utterly indiscriminate. And that can be a bad thing. So how can journalism, which at its best is the discriminating selection and investigation of what is reportable information, survive in this world? And tonight I'm going to look at the print media. And Monday, in my second of these talks, I'll look at the broadcast media as well. But the lesson's going to be the same for both of them. It is going to struggle mightily. So to begin with, here's a very brief history of newspapers in this country. I don't know how much you know about where they came from. The first recognised newspaper in Britain was, happily enough, given our location tonight, the Oxford Gazette, founded in 1665 as a mouthpiece for the Crown. It was born out of the aggressive pamphleteering of the Civil War period, where debates about the role of free speech began to rise alongside the calls for more representative democracy. And around this time, John Milton, author of Paradise Lost, wrote a polemic against government attempts to license free speech, which he called Areopagitica, named after a hill in Athens. And in it, he issued a clarion call that has continued to resound. Give me the liberty to know, to utter, and to argue freely according to conscience above all liberties. But before we get misty-eyed, he then said this. The bottom one, those which otherwise come forth, if they found to be mischievous and libelous, the fire and the executioner will be the timeliest and the most effectual remedy that man's prevention can use. So Milton was thus the godfather of the I believe in free expression but brigade, who've been active in our country ever since. The first daily paper came along in 1702, the Daily Courant. It was published by a woman called Elizabeth Mallet, who thus had more journalistic power than many women in the centuries that followed. Journalism at its upper echelons, of course, remains in 2018 almost periodically white and male, the current scandal of BBC unequal pay, a scandal that, of course, exists in every aspect of this industry and most others, is only the latest manifestation of that. So soon after, we started to get recognisable titles by recognisable journalists. Daniel Defoe began the Review in 1704. Richard Steele produced the Tatler in 1709. Steele and Addison, the Spectator, in 1711. Addison said this, "There is no humour in my countrymen which I'm more inclined to wonder at than their general thirst for news." It was a British characteristic. We like news. By the end of the century, that thirst was gratified on 7 days of the week. The Observer appears in 1791, the first Sunday newspaper in Britain. Then in the 18th century, the newspapers were glorying in this title of the Fourth Estate. It's a term usually credited to Edmund Burke, but it's probably coined a bit later by Macaulay. And this pandered to the newspaper's sense, which they still have, of being a central pillar of society. It's probably best typified in the person of John Wilkes, who was both an MP and a journalist, and published the North Britain newspaper in 1761, which trumpeted this. "The liberty of the press is the birthright of a Briton and is justly esteemed the firmest bulwark of this country. It has been the terror of all bad ministers, for their dark and dangerous designs or their weakness, inability and duplicity have thus been detected and shown to the public, generally in too strong and just colours for them long to bear up against the odium of mankind." Journalists ever since have liked to see themselves as the firebrand heir to Wilkes. The extent to which that is true has ever since also been something of an open question. When Wilkes was arrested for sedition, the state attempted to burn copies of his newspaper. There was a riot in order to prevent it. If someone today tried to burn copies of a newspaper in the street, there would be a queue to join in. And actually, anybody who thinks about journalism or cares about journalism really needs to reflect on that, because you saw it at election time, newspapers were being burnt and people were applauding. In any event, the next century saw an explosion of newspaper titles, including more than 50 in London alone. Newspapers used to be heavily taxed, and then in 1855 that tax was repealed. And even today, newsprint is untaxed in terms of VAT, because there's an idea that the beneficial effects of reading should be encouraged. And so a tax break exists for the written word. Newspapers don't pay VAT. It doesn't extend to digital journalism, interestingly. But anyway, circulation started to grow in this period, the 19th century. So the 20th century began, adult literacy hit 97%, which is still unsurpassed today, and almost every adult read a newspaper. The Daily Mail, hooray, became the first paper to sell 1 million copies on its own. It's the first paper to be aimed at women readers, and it remains the only paper today with a female-dominated readership. That's why it's so much filled with content written by women for women who hate women. The Daily Mirror was launched in 1903 as the first picture-dominated tabloid. It reached a circulation high of 5 million in 1964. It probably sells 500,000 today in a country that's obviously a lot larger. It went on to spawn as a competitor, The Sun, which was relaunched in 1969, having been purchased by Rupert Murdoch. And so you're beginning to see the familiar figures of the British newspaper world. And they've been familiar for decades. They've been easy to caricature for decades. You may have seen this in a sitcom. That's unfair a bit and reductive, but it certainly used to be the case, and it's an interesting thing, that British national identity could be readily represented by its national press. If you gave a Martian a copy of The Guardian, The Times, The Mail and The Sun, they'd have a fair sense of the thinking of the nation. That's probably no longer the case, actually. It'd be a fair sense of maybe the thinking of the older generation, or parts of the older generation. A fair summary primarily of the indigenous population of the country, too. Jim Hacker didn't mention The Independent because it didn't exist at the time. It was once a proud liberal entity, of course, but it's now largely a clickbait website trying to lure in unheeding millennials. Even in the past, it was open to parody, though, and this is from the brilliant sitcom The Thick of It. This is the news editor of The Mail complaining.
Just tell me what the fucking news is and I'll put it on the front page. It's not like we're The Independent. We can't just stick a headline saying cruelty and then stick a picture of a dolphin or a whale on it.
Very good, hasn't it? Hackett didn't mention the Express titles, by the way, run by the Napoleon of bad journalism, Richard Desmond, although he's about to sell it to the Mirror. Their plunge in circulation, their endlessly, repetitively inaccurate journalism, their preoccupation with the weather and ailments of the elderly and Princess Diana are the supreme example of the problems for newspapers. In search of an audience who might still pay for them, it's easy for a newspaper to become unappetizing to anybody new. And that's what's happened to The Express. I met Richard Desmond once at a party, and I was introduced to him, and he glared at me, his little porcine eyes set deep within the recesses of his flushed face, and he paused and said, "Are you fucking queer?" And I said, "No, as it happens." And he said, "Well, you've got a beard," and walked off. I wish there was a more profound conclusion to that story, but it's just that's what happened. I met Richard Desmond, and that was it. Now, I'm not saying that newspapers are now particularly poorly produced compared to their forebears. They're not. There's never really been a golden age of British journalism. It's always been a messy, contingent business populated by the angry and the passionate, the troublesome and the discontented. It's actually really striking that even at their peak, newspapers have consistently been regarded as immoral and too fond of the salacious or scabrous story. Walter Scott, in 1829, called journalism a disgrace and a degradation. And he said he'd rather sell gin to poor people and poison them that way. In 1938, a government report bemoaned the slide towards celebrity tittle-tattle. A dangerous tendency has recently been manifesting itself by which entertainment ceases to be ancillary to news and either supersedes it or absorbs it. Many people welcome a newspaper that, under the guise of presenting news, enables them to escape from the grimness of actual events and the effort of thought by opening the back door of triviality and sex appeal. Such readers are left ill-informed and unable to participate intelligently in the political debate. You could imagine people tweeting a shorter version of that today. It's 1938. We'll come back to The Sun in a second. So the spectre of snobbery when discussing popular journalism is neither a particularly new or an unfamiliar one, and concerns have always subsisted that the influence of newspapers has been malign or immoral. especially when it comes to this participation in the political debate. Stanley Baldwin, of course, famously in 1931 said, "What the proprietorship of these papers is aiming at is power, and power without responsibility, the prerogative of the harlot throughout the ages." Newspaper proprietors and editors play up to this, of course. Before every election, there are always pompous editorials in which a title declares for a particular side. But it's impossible to prove, actually, how influential they actually are at all. The Sun, which has supported the winning side in every election since 1979, published this headline. It was The Sun what won it. And it's really striking to me how this claim, which is self-evidently one of swaggering bravado by a swaggering editor, is taken seriously by a commentariat who are sceptical of the paper's veracity in almost every other respect. But we're expected to say it is The Sun what won it. And it's probably the case that that's never been true. The Sun has always been as much interested in following its readership as leading it. It supported Brexit for that reason in 2016. It supported the Conservatives in 2017, along with 60% of its readers. And I actually was in the Sun newsroom on the election night of 2015, where all the talk, if you remember, had been on the rise of Milibandism and the probability of a hung parliament. And the 10 p.m. exit poll suggested a narrow Tory win. And cheers erupted in the newsroom. And that's not really because of party loyalty. Many journalists who work on The Sun, possibly even most of them, aren't Tory voters. But The Sun's line had been endorsed. There's a fleeting feeling that it remained relevant to its readers. But if you look at the 2017 election, it's been calculated that the readership of the right-leaning press, The Mail, The Sun, The Express, accounted for about 4 million actual voters. 4 million. Which is a significant amount, but it's not exactly a dominant portion of the overall electorate. Almost a third of Sun readers voted Labour, despite what the paper had been telling them. So while the broader influence of newspapers is overstated, their role in the political life of this country probably isn't. Some of it is healthy and legitimate. The 2009 scandal of the MPs' expenses were broken by The Telegraph, possibly the exemplar of public interest journalism on behalf of the public. There's also an example of checkbook journalism, by the way. It costs £350,000, The Telegraph, to buy that off someone. Probably wouldn't have the resources to do it now. So 2009, not that long ago, it would have had more money to do a story like that. And newspapers, even tabloids, devote plenty of space and resource to political coverage. And they act as something of a conscience pricker to those in power. Newspapers also do something else. They set the agenda followed by broadcasters. And that's a real silent power of newspapers, because radio and TV news often picks up what they're doing. Political journalists have an unusual relationship with their subjects. It's part friendly, part hostile, an assault that ever threatens to become an embrace. It's a very strange thing when you see political journalists and politicians together. Both sides need each other. MPs want to push out their messages and to feel important. Lobby journalists need to have stories to bring back to the news desk. The term lobby journalist, then, if you know this, by the way, dates back to 1885, when in the wake of security concerns over nationalist terrorism, the lobby of the House of Commons was restricted to all but a privileged number of named reporters. They became the lobby. And they're still a privileged bunch, actually. They share stories and some contacts and are given access to power that they really do guard jealously and furtively. This is from a guide to the lobby from 1940, which makes it sound a bit like Fight Club. "Don't talk about lobby meetings. If outsiders appear to know that a lobby meeting is to be or has been held, do not confirm their conjectures." It's a society, a secret society. Objective observers might argue that political journalists are too close to their subjects. The lobby system is too cosy and mutually beneficial. It wasn't the lobby that broke the MP's expenses scandal, for example. But one of the things that's often not considered is proximity to the source of information is now one of the features of our age. And thanks to live blogging, tweeting, and 24-hour news, we all probably are better informed about the working of Parliament and the behaviour of elected officials than we ever have been in any point in our history. So it's thanks to journalism that most people have a sense of how political institutions work, and that's a good thing. I wonder how many people actually understand how the journalistic institutions work. So I thought I'd give you a quick guide, because when you come into newspapers, I started at the PCC, which was kept away from the actual workings of papers, but then I went to see how they actually worked. It's like all trades, it has its own mysteries and idiolects, you know, splashes and subdecks, the backbench, wobs and gutters. There's a whole terminology around it. There's also a reasonable question how each day a readable, generally speaking, product is created from scratch, containing tens of thousands of words to set alongside pictures and adverts. And it's a reasonable question to ask, how the hell does that happen? Because even when you're in the middle of it, the process feels very unlikely. Newspaper production is a total, scarcely controlled shambles from the beginning to the end. Newspapers start with a flat plan, a sheet of paper with the outline of each page on it, with the space for adverts marked on already. And that's the first point everyone should recognise. Advertising dictates the shape of a newspaper. The stories are designed to fit around the adverts, not the other way around. A newspaper without advertising is dead. And that's a crucial point to remember. It's easy to forget, but the first several pages of newspapers used only to be adverts. The first time that the Times ran a front page which was not filled with ads was to announce the death of Winston Churchill in January 1965. Today, newspapers will almost do anything for any money, so return to the idea of front page adverts at the top or the bottom, or wraps concealing the front page entirely, but it used to be the sole purpose of the paper. And this is critical, because a collapse in commercial rather than circulation revenue is the main reason why the newspaper industry is in such dangerous decline. Advertising spend that used to go to print now goes to two American companies, Facebook and Google, with nothing to replace it. Back in the 80s and 90s, editors could simply chuck out adverts they didn't like if they felt it interrupted the flow or spoiled the look of a page, and they would do it arrogantly. They'd do it without consulting the team who'd sold the advert. They'd do it without telling the client who'd bought the advert. They'd simply look at an ad and throw it in the bin, 30 grams worth, and they wouldn't be worried about it. Now they would get on bended knee and thank the advertiser for advertising with them. But for a long, long period in recent newspaper history, they had so much coming in, they weren't worried about it. Newspapers are, I don't know if you know this, organised by desks. So there's a news desk, a features desk, sport, pictures in tabloids, there's showbiz and TV, and broadsheets, foreign and business. And the editor of each desk's job each morning is to collate all the possible stories from all of the reporters, staff or freelance, so they can create a list to present to the editor at morning conference. And conference is different at each paper. At The Guardian, they used to be under Alan Rusbridger, who I now believe is of this parish. It used to be a small meeting to review the previous day's efforts, followed by a group discussion involving potentially the entire staff of the paper, who used to troop into a large room filled with cheerfully yellow sofas. They even invited guests to speak at it. I've done it myself. And it felt like a very civilised salon, quite suiting the paper's elevated view of itself, and quite really unlike what I've seen elsewhere. The Daily Mail's conference takes place in the editor's plush, walnut-lined office. Paul Dacre sits glowering from behind his enormous desk, which has no computer on it. Sofas are pushed back to the walls, and the centre is occupied by the news editor, sitting on a chair, like the victim of an interrogation. It's supposed to be one of the most frightening things in all of journalism, and the news editor's job is the hardest in all of journalism. It's almost always a he, although the news editor of the Sunday Times is now a woman, is tasked with producing a list that not only covers what he believes to be the main stories of the day, but also stories that are exclusive to the title. It's a thankless task. The pressure, which is bad now, used to be unbearable. At The Sun, several years ago, the editor was so appalled by the list at conference, it was screwed up, thrown at the news editor. Conference was cancelled, and 15 minutes later, an email went to every member of staff in the whole building, including from people at different newspapers, asking for stories, with, quote, this reason, because the news editor apparently doesn't have any. And competition between newspapers is now almost non-existent, but back in the day, it used to be the dynamic that powered the whole industry. At night, hacks would be sent to train stations to get the first editions, and they'd run to them, and they'd look through them and call the office and say, what's in the rival publications? Stories would be nicked, bollockings would be given, how did you miss this page 15 in this paper? Lies would be pretty much made a misery. And unsurprisingly, in such an atmosphere of mistrust and controlled panic, ethical standards were liable to slip. And war stories, journalists like all professions love their war stories. The news editor who was so angry at the loss of a story, he suffered an asthma attack and had to have emergency treatment in the newsroom, and people just walked around him as it was happening. Or the journalist who actually feigned a heart attack to escape a confrontation with his boss, but his boss knew he was faking it, so he was there twitching on the floor, and his boss continued to shout at him for the 10 minutes while it was going on. This is the great Christopher Hitchens sharing his war stories, which have the absolute ring of truth about it. Anybody here raped and speaks English? That's the Express Foreign Desk. And the slightly funnier one, the Express scribe in some hellhole, his copy surpassed by a Daily Mailman who had received an honourable flesh wound, received a cable, mailman shot, why you unshot? Which again has the ring of truth about it. Come back to that. So morning conference involves the editor listening to the proposed story of the day. The afternoon is then spent in the preparation of copy by journalists, which is then channeled into the system, passed before a lawyer. Meanwhile, the whole other side of the operation kicks in at the same time. This is the back bench of a newspaper, the group of editors led by a night editor, whose job it is to see that the physical product, the thing that we get, is created to the highest standard. They're the most senior and significant figures in the operation of the paper. So once stories are ready, they're subbed, checked for sense, and cut to the size required. And writers obviously hate that. No one likes their prose being cut. Henry James used to write for the TLS back in the day, and once the editor removed a sentence and a half of Henry James's prose, he returned the proofs with this note: "Here is the bleeding corpse, yours is a butcher's trade." And I've had similar things from writers today. So throughout the day, pages get drawn, the tessellating you see in newspapers, get created, headlines are written and rewritten. In this early evening, the same conference process happens again to ensure that all the stuff that's gone on in the day has worked out. Pages are scrapped, stories are changed. The Mail, Daily Mail, it's a source of great pride that at 7 o'clock marks the time which everything significant is started again. The editor is on the prowl with his green pen and his notoriously foul mouth, and stuff that's been done throughout the day is scrapped and starts again. After that point, the decision is finalised as to what the front page, the splash, will look like. And at The Sun, this was one of the most important jobs of the editor. Before, say, 2010, a newspaper could ship an extra 100,000 copies on the strength of having a good story. That's a rarity now, let me tell you. But the craftsmanship of headlines is one of the joys of tabloid journalism. If you go to The Sun today, meeting rooms are named after famous headlines. Like these, so... How do you solve a problem like Korea? Or this is a famous football report, Supercaligo-ballistic Celtic are atrocious. And there's a room with that as the name in it when you go there. Headline writing is a competitive sport. People sit at their desks, brows furrowed, trying to come up with the funniest line. There's a competition every month to who can do the best headline. So when I was at The Sun, I tried to get involved very rarely successfully, but I remember my first couple of months, they were going to do a front page story about, of all things, the rise of TB in dogs, and it's quite a hard thing to do a headline for that, particularly one that fits the bottom. So I got involved and I suggested this, and then when you see it in the shops the next day, I felt this flicker of pride. Tuberculosis Rex, which, you know, TB dogs, I'll say it's brilliant, but you know, got in. Yeah, thank you. I had Coffer Spaniel was my other one, but that didn't work. Here's another one, actually, when I was there. There was an investigation into cocaine use over Christmas in cathedral toilets. Don't ask. The headline was, "Ding dong merrily we're high," which again, I think is quite funny. But the problem for any tabloid editor, particularly tabloid editors, is that a front page must be clear and decisive and unequivocal, while reality is virtually never any of those things. And that's why headlines are apt for criticism, scorn and parody as soon as they appear. And if you talk to any editor, they'll say a decision they took at 9 o'clock in the evening looks very different at 9 o'clock in the morning. Newspapers' first editions go off stone about 9 to 10:30. They're sent to printers all around the country. The first editions will then be packaged and delivered to the furthest reaches of the UK. The second edition comes at midnight and maybe a third one after that. And we don't think about this, but as a feat of logistics, it's an exceptional daily performance involving an entire micro-economy of people, printers, drivers, news agents and the like. And when you see people demanding for papers to be shut down, which is a common blurt of the social media militant, it's actually worth thinking of the employment of thousands of people who rely on newspapers' existence. And that's a perilous thing. And as I explain all of this process, you can see why the predicament of newspapers is so perilous. All of that form, all of that structure, when news is happening constantly and can now be transmitted instantly. And that structure also prevents communication between the person writing a story and the person then responsible for its production. Often a tabloid reporter will file 1,500 words to the desk, which will then be subbed down to 600 words by one person, given a headline by another person, under the direction of several other people. None of those people will ever have spoken to the person who wrote the story. It's Chinese whispers. A newspaper is a factory of Chinese whispers. And in that sense, it's not surprising that so many stories have errors. It's surprising how few actually have errors. Now, of course, almost all newspapers now run corrections columns, an idea pioneered in Britain by The Guardian. And although accuracy is a serious business and newspapers are rightly criticised for getting things wrong, there's a lot of joy to be had in the mistakes that are made. I remember a poor woman who complained to me at the Press Complaints Commission about a misprint in a local newspaper story that told of her heroic struggle against debilitating back pain during a working day in which she, quote, was not able to have time for a sit. And a stray H had entered the last word of that to her total mortification. So I thought I'd just do here my three favourite newspaper corrections of recent times. New York Times, because of an editing error, an article on Monday about a theological battle being fought by Muslim imams and scholars in the West against the Islamic State, misstated the Snapchat channel used by Sahab Webb, one of the Muslim leaders speaking out. It is Imam Suhai Webb, not Pimpin' for Paradise 786. I'd like to have the conversation that led to that correction being made. This from The Sun. In an article on Saturday headlined Flying Saucers Over British Scientology HQ, we stated two flat silver discs were seen above the Church of Scientology. Following a letter from lawyers for the church, we apologise to any life forms for linking them to And just so you know why that's a particularly blurry thing, Scientologists are the most litigious of any organisation in the world. They have no sense of humour whatsoever. So that would have been extremely annoying for them, which is, of course, why it was done. I like this one because you can so see how it happened. Our team was the worst in the First Division, and I'm sure it'll be the worst in the Premier League, said the owner of Wolverhampton Wanderers. Our team was the worst in the First Division. Profuse apologies, indeed. I'll come back to that, that's good. Online journalism is, of course, prone, if not more so, to error. Never wrong for long is the clarion call that resounds across its serried ranks. And it does still produce great corrections, though. This is the best tweet correction I've ever seen. ISIS fighters are shaving bears and hiding in civilian homes to avoid airs. Ah, it was beards, not bears. So we should compare the overall process of digital newspaper journalism, which often in newspapers is running at the same time on the same floor as the print operation. In a title like The Guardian, the emphasis will be on the digital journalism. It's much more important to The Guardian than the paper is. So a small team takes the digital journalism and repurposes it for the paper. In mass market titles, you have completely separate online teams, and their stories are written by young, underpaid people chiseling out rubbish by writing captions to pictures, grabbing items from social media, and stealing stories from every other site, which is in turn simultaneously stealing stories from them. In July 2017, the trade magazine Press Gazette ran a story in which it showed how The Independent had refused to pay for material it had stolen from Wales Online. And this is what it said: there's no copyright in news, which kind of sounds a bit like there's no honour among thieves. And indeed, there is an entire ecology of crapness at the heart of most digital journalism today. And it creates an almost entirely homogenous product. The websites of, say, The Independent and The Express are not that dissimilar. They are both in search of the crack cocaine of a click, whatever the consequences in terms of quality. And it's an apt coincidence that the term hit actually works for both drug taking and online consumption, because they both reflect a need for a short-term and satisfying delivery of excitement. That's all it is. Stories are now packaged by a social team, clever young folk who try to use Facebook and Twitter to get you interested. And this has become a homogenous trade in itself with its own new birth cliches. This woman's response to a sexy text will amaze you. J.K. Rowling just destroyed Donald Trump. That would be a story, actually, if that were true. The Pope's view on the refugee crisis might shock you. You'll have seen some today. They're everywhere. You can't escape them. And other stories are written solely to satisfy the search engine of Google. Journalists are told to write articles that simply answer questions that you might search. These are genuine ones. Who is Piers Morgan and why is he not presenting GMB today? What time is Chelsea versus Manchester United on? How do I cook a turkey? QTWAIM, questions to which the answer is no. And that's the problem. The economics of online journalism are now scarcely better than offline journalism. To get more clicks, you need more stories. To get more stories, you need more people churning out things quickly. There's an unbreakable link between overhead and scale. So websites are now as burdensome as printing presses. They were going to be the great liberation from the world of printing. They're exactly the same. They're too unwieldy, too resource-heavy, too hard to sustain. And meanwhile, display advertising is collapsing in the digital world as much as it's collapsing in the print world. And the basic rule of economics is in play here. Supply and demand. There is an unlimited supply of stories. So there can be no rise in demand for space. Advertising yields are going down online rather than going up. Most digital ads go in two places. Facebook, which acts as a portal to the whole internet, and Google, which controls what you see when you search. So here's some figures. 2016, Google took £4.6 billion of ad revenue. Facebook took £1.6 billion of ad revenue. Every single British news organisation together took £420 million. And it's those people who paid for the journalism. They're the ones who had the overhead. Google, no overhead. Facebook, no overhead. In 2016, of all the new digital advertising growth, 94%, £1 billion, went to Google and Facebook. More than half of all digital market now goes to those. And it's worth reflecting on this. Mail Online, which is either the first or second largest news website in the world, doesn't make any money, or not very much money. BuzzFeed, a site designed to be the brave new world, have no display advertising. It mainly gets its revenue from native advertising, which is to say sponsored content, mainly video. The idea is that Heinz, say, will pay for a series of videos about sandwiches, and that will then be shared. And that's a good way of making money. It can bring back a substantial return. It's not clear that BuzzFeed makes any money. And then last year, what did we see at BuzzFeed? Its own wave of redundancies. The very same pattern of print journalism reproduced inexorably in the new media. It's a perilous, perilous position. I'll talk more about the issue of trust on Monday when I do another one of these, but it's clear that the reputation of journalists and journalism has got worse. It's never good to begin with, but it's got worse. Andrew Marr, he of the notably knobbly physiognomy, said this in a book in 2004. Somehow, somewhere along the road, journalists stopped being shabby heroes confronting arrogant power and became sleazy, pig-snouted villains. The phone hacking scandal, which I saw something of when I was at the PCC, epitomised this. And phone hacking, the interception of voice messages on phones by either guessing or blagging the password, it probably arose, or at least got widespread traction, at Mirror Group newspapers in the mid-1990s. It was then brought across to the news of the world. And to showbiz journalists, it was this revolutionary thing, the chance to eavesdrop on personal messages, and far more importantly to them, to stand up gossipy stories. If star X is seeing star Y, a voice message between them confirms the relationship. And what it represented, collectively, was a failure by journalists and their managers to care about people's privacy. So transfixed were they by this desire for a story. The pressure of the time meant that exclusivity, in tabloids and middle market papers especially, compromised journalists' integrity. And the scandal in the end engulfed not only the News of the World, which had to close, but other papers, the Conservative Party, the police force, the PCC, where I was working. And it led, thanks to a panicking David Cameron, who had oddly decided to employ in government someone involved in phone hacking, to the Leveson Inquiry, which Robert mentioned earlier. It was a public investigation into the culture and ethics of the newspaper industry. Now, if you talk to any newspaper people about Leveson, they'll grumble and curse, even now. And there's some justification. I mean, it was a kangaroo court in public in which anyone with a gripe against the press over the previous 20 or 30 years had a chance to make allegations. Can you imagine a similar inquiry into the practice of lawyers, or doctors, or lawyers? But Leveson was actually salutary and necessary. After all, British newspapers had spent the previous 300 years making allegations without consequences. And some of the criticisms were, of course, justified and needed to be heard. And editors needed to be brought out from behind their desk. And editors are extraordinary characters, in my experience. They're this weird blend of iron ego and fragile flower. They're sort of responsible for everything in their paper, but they don't actually do very much. If a national newspaper editor was arrested at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the paper would still get out. The Guardian's famous editor, most famous editor, C.P. Scott, didn't even show up in the office till 7 o'clock at night. He was a serving MP at the time, and the paper still got out. And editors wield this ultimate power, and they're seldomly publicly held to account. This is Anthony Trollope writing about the fictional journalist Tom Towers in The Warden, which I think is in 1855. I'll just read the end bit for you. To whom was he, Tom Towers, responsible? No one could insult him. No one could inquire into him. Well, 150 years later, Leveson did inquire to him. And these bashful editorial figures despised the harshly unforgiving bright lights of a courtroom. But the Leveson process was probably a rightful nemesis to their collective hubris. It was clear that Leveson wanted a straightforward answer to an impossible problem that goes all the way back to Milton. How do you regulate a free press? How do you shackle something that society needs to both be restrained and free? An especially pressing problem when most information is being consumed online via social media and unregulated websites, often from another country. And his eventual report had more than 1 million words in it. It had scarcely a few thousand about the internet. It was doomed to irrelevancy almost as soon as it was published. It led to the PCC being replaced by a body called IPSO, which has slightly more powers, but still has minimal impact on the rest of journalism. IPSO doesn't regulate the FT, the Evening Standard, the Independent, Reuters, anything on Facebook. The vast majority of journalism you read in this country is unregulated. It is, like much of the press industry, an anachronism. And now we've got this absurd constitutional hodgepodge that supports press regulation in the country. Papers have to sign up to a recognised regulatory body, a body recognised by government, to avoid being punished in court. It's scarcely credible, but true. Newspapers who are not signed up to a recognised regulator have to pay the costs of another side in a dispute, even if they win, theoretically, and face exemplary damages if they lose. It's unlikely to actually hold water. The Human Rights Act takes care of it. But it remains on our statute books. It's not been properly enforced yet. So we've had a 5 years after a once-in-a-generation inquiry, the regulation of print media is in the same sorry state it ever was. So when we come to print journalism, the economics are bad, the regulation is bad, the pattern of consumption is bad. And this is across the world. In America, 20,000 journalism jobs have been lost in the last 10 years. 20,000. In Britain, the number of journalists working in local newspapers has halved in the same time. Local papers used to be the place where everyone learnt their trade, and they've been hollowed out to such an extent they've been overwhelmed by technology, by Facebook, by the regional power of the BBC. They used to be the voice of communities, respected and given credibility, because they were written by people who lived with them. Their economics are shot entirely. They were very different from national editors. This is J.B. Priestley back in the 30s. This is true. I've never been able to understand how London editors can try to know what their readers want, because they never meet any of their readers, never exchange a word with them. They are no more in touch with the actual public than are Grand Lamas. That's totally true about London editors. They're a really historically cosseted bunch, ferried to work in air-conditioned luxury. Their every whim constantly being catered for. But local news is no longer really a viable industry at all. In 5 years' time, you will be more likely to meet a Grand Lama than you will a local newspaper editor. And the same economic woes exist for national titles too. There are more PRs in London massaging the messages in stories than there are journalists writing them. Best-selling newspaper in Britain, The Sun, the best-selling broadsheet, The Telegraph, sell less than half they did in 2000. The Times has just overtaken The Telegraph. Anybody now running a newspaper, and I know this, spends more time contemplating cost-cutting and mass redundancies than doing anything else. That's what you do if you're in a newspaper. Rupert Murdoch, who owns The Sun and The Times, is said to have predicted once that in the end only three newspapers in Britain will be left standing: The Sun, The Times and The Daily Mail. And that prediction is actually looking optimistic rather than pessimistic. As it stands, the economic model for much journalism, especially the unglamorous routine reporting of what's happened across our daily lives, is broken. And there may be some grounds for hope, but on the famous journalistic principle that good news is no news, I'm going to leave that for another day. If you come back on Monday, there may be a glimmer of hope in my second talk. But just to cheer everyone up, because that's been quite gloomy for the last 10 minutes, here's another funny joke from Twitter. According to research, 9 out of 10 people don't notice replace words with random musical instruments. Thank you very much for listening.